It's time for The Car Doctor on AM 950 WROL. Got a car question? Call us at 617-770-3030. That's 617-770-3030. Now, here's The Car Doctor, John Paul, on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston.
Good Saturday morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the spirit of Boston, or maybe you're listening on our FM channel, 100.3 FM, if you're in the Boston metro area, or maybe you're listening online on WROLradio.com or any one of the radio apps. You can usually find us there. We have an interesting program lined up for today. Among other things, we will be reviewing the 2019 Nissan 370Z. Talk about some of the latest information in the automotive world, as well as an event that's going to be sort of taking place at the Heritage Museum and Gardens. So we have that coming up. I finally did get a copy of Rick from Boston's letter. Finally showed up, made its way through the radio station and got it there. So we'll talk about that in a bit. So we have a lot of things to talk about this morning, including, like I said, some of the things that are in the news and some of the updates that are coming up, and maybe whether I don't want to say made a mistake buying the Hyundai Santa Fe that I bought, because Hyundai came out with a brand new Santa Fe. And we'll have to see how the two compare, the one that I purchased, compared to the new one that's coming out, and we'll talk about that. So we have a lot of things going on this morning. So as well as we are going to be talking to Elliot Friend from, he's on the automotive committee down at the Heritage Museum and Gardens. And we'll be talking to him in just a bit. So we have a lot of things going on. And we have Keith in the studio again. I'm not in the studio because, well, it's a three-day weekend. So I'm going to try to take advantage of it as much as I can. So we have that going on. So lots of things going on. And, well, we'll just kind of go from there and see what we got going on. And, in fact, I got a news release that we'll get into a little bit later as well. So with us on the phone is Elliot Friend. Elliot is on the automotive committee down at the Heritage Museum and Gardens. Elliot, good morning, and welcome to the Car Doctor program.
Good morning. Good morning. How's everybody this morning?
Well, better than I deserve, as some people would say. First off, let's talk about the Heritage Museum and Gardens. You guys have been there for an awfully long time, and you have what has been described as cars in a church-like setting. It's a beautiful place down there.
Yes, it is. When Josiah Lilly founded it and purchased the property in 1967, he was a collector, had collected some 36, 37 cars, and he wanted a place where the public could view the car collection, military miniatures collections that he had, purchased the property and built the building, which is a resemblance of a Shaker round barn.
Yeah, it really is a beautiful building. I think it might have been Dave Brunell who kind of said it's in a church-like setting. Dave Brunell, people know him from from Hemmings Motor News. Just a great guy, and I had the opportunity to meet Mr. Lilly years back. I was asked to come down and do a little talk at the museum, and he was in the audience, so no pressure there, you know. It was but it was quite a thing, and the cars are absolutely stunning that you have there, and you have an interesting exhibit there right now, the IndyCar exhibit.
Yes, this year There's 41 cars in the total collection this year. 21 of the cars are in off-site storage, and arrangements were made to have 20 cars from the Indianapolis 500 exhibit in Indianapolis there for the season, starting with the first pace car in 1912, Stoddard Dayton, which is a name unknown today, and each car of the next generation is about a 5 to 6 year span to the next car to the next car, and the most current one is the 2016 winning Indy car, the Napa car.
It is really a stunning collection, and it's a little bit to the point where you have a car that you can climb in and out of, and you realize these cars are pretty small inside.
Yes, they are. Yeah, there's one car there that's been modified where folks, adults, children can get in and out of. And then there's other accessories, we'll call them, on a table there. There's a bottle of milk that I'd say either taking a little taste of or poured on top of the winner. There's a wreath, there's some helmets, and some other pieces there. And then there's a mural on the wall behind the car standing next to the Indy 500 trophy, where a visitor could stand there, get their picture taken in that setting.
It's really a great thing, and there certainly is, has always been a little bit of everything for everyone there. But you have something pretty interesting coming up in the next week or so. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The Classic Car Club of America, the New England region, is putting on what's called a mini caravan and a Grand National, which is a judged car show. It'll be held at Heritage a week from Saturday on the 8th. Cars will be on display there from 10 in the morning till 2. And at this point, we have 41 cars, classic cars, coming in from really across the country. We've got some a car coming from Alabama, another couple cars coming from Florida. Full classic cars, which is the Classic Car Club of America, the full classics, they were built between 1915 and 1948. And these were cars that must meet the high standards of quality, design, engineering. Just to toss a couple of names out, Rolls-Royce, Packard, Duesenberg, Lincoln, and Cadillac were some of the names of cars. They were the, let's say the more expensive cars, the high-end premium cars that are what the Classic Car Club of America is all about.
I would say Duesenberg, Cadillac, Lincoln, Packard. Yeah, we're talking a pretty good collection of high-end cars there. And if people are on the Cape, they're going to see these cars here and there, because I was looking at some of the schedule on next Thursday. I guess they're headed over to the Widder Pirate Museum in Yarmouth, and then up to the Sandwich Glass Museum, and on Friday headed down to Chatham to the Marconi Maritime Center, and then like you said, Saturday they're going to be at the Heritage Museum, and then probably head out after that. So people who happen to be on the road over the next week or so may see a beautiful collection of cars driving down the road and wondering, what happened? Did I just get transported back in time?
Yes, if that would be a perfect way to describe it. Yeah, the tour, it's about 150-160-mile tour that'll happen over the 2 days out there. Then, as I said before, the cars will be on display at Heritage. So anybody coming to visit Heritage for the day, they'll have access, they'll have ability. There's no extra charge or anything up on the parade field. They can just wander up there, walk around, look at the cars, talk with the owners, and see some beautiful pieces of art.
No, absolutely. A little off topic, how did you get involved in the Heritage Museum and sort of the as an automotive historian to some extent?
Well, I'll be a little careful here. No, I retired from my career.
Yep.
And moved to Plymouth. We're from the Northeast and just wanted to get over this way. We got some kids and grandkids in the area, but I've always had an interest in car. I've had, you know, any number over my years. One day we wandered down to Heritage, walked in the building. I looked around and said, boy, I wonder if there's any volunteer opportunities here. Got in touch with the Jennifer Madden, who's the director of the collection.
Mm-hmm.
Visited with her and got on the auto committee and have been enjoying it for the last 6.5 years. Coming in pretty much on a weekly basis. With another group of fellows on our subcommittee, and we take care of the cars, exercise them, do any service work that need be done on them, and have also been on a project of reactivating, because we've got a few of the cars that are still not fully active. We've been on a program of reactivating a car a year over the last 6 years.
Yeah, no, that's what's pretty amazing. Besides the, I mean, sometimes you go to a museum and the cars are stunning to look at, but they haven't been driven in an awfully long time, and I've seen kind of in the back room down there, and now you make it open, almost sort of open to the public, and you see folks like yourself in there and really looking to get the cars ready and up to a point where people can the cars are truly real, and they're not just exhibit pieces. You can, with a little bit of work, get them up and running. And I know a friend of mine, Glenn Gould, the Wells Auto Museum, when his dad was alive, that was one of the things his father always kind of prided himself on, that with a little bit of work, every car in that museum could start up and run.
Yeah. Well, it's important to preserve them for the future, the next generation and the next generation. They really need to be active. They need to be started, driven around, and just get everything moving and keep them in that condition. If they just sit idle, they're going to deteriorate, and that's not right.
That's right. No, it's interesting too, because sometimes people lose track of cars. And last week we had somebody on from Ford, and we were talking about a little bit of Ford history, and we kind of went off topic a little bit and talked about the Ford sweepstakes car that a lot of people remember, the only time Henry Ford ever raced. And and they made a copy of the car to sort of bring back to life, and they thought they were making a copy of a copy, and after doing a little bit of research, they found out it was actually the original car that someone just sort of stuck in storage. But they really thought, oh, this is a reproduction of the car from the early 1900s. And after a little bit of work, they found out it was really the original car. And I guess they may have not been quite as careful with it when they were first starting to take pieces off of it to mold new pieces for this reproduction vehicle. Then as they were going through it, they found out, oh, this is actually the original car. And so it's important, I think, to always kind of preserve this. And I think it's important to get Dave Brunell and Terry Eric up at Hemmings always used to say, we need to get the next generation of people involved in the old car hobby. And I think seeing a grand collection of cars like that is coming to the museum, or that you have on display, or even for the enthusiasts, the Indy cars that are there, it can bring a new excitement. And I think it's important for parents and grandparents to bring their kids to car shows and bring them to auto museums and let them learn a little bit about the history of, you know, what the cars are, and then they'll hopefully bring that with them to their generation.
Yes, now without question, there, now without question, just Yes.
It sounds like I went up on a soapbox a little bit here, but
no,
I think
it's
it,
all right.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah, I think it is so important. So, back to the original topic, the cars will be on display next Saturday, and about what time?
10 a.m.
10 a.m.
Open. We're going to be bringing cars in, you know, getting them all staged on the parade field. Each car will have its specific parking space, so to speak. And then from 10 o'clock till 2 o'clock, it's open, as I said before, included with admission. There's going to be a lunch service there for anybody that wants to, be there at noontime.
Mm-hmm.
We're having a catering company come in. They'll have hamburgers, hot dogs, and sodas and the like available for folks to purchase there. I just looked at the weather this morning, and it looks to be good for Saturday. So we're happy.
Yeah. No. It sounds like a great thing. And again, the Heritage Museum and Gardens is someplace where everyone can go if you want to go. You know, check out all the cars, if you want to go check out all of the flowers, if you want to go check out the other exhibits, there is a lot of stuff there. And as everybody reminds me, if you have a little bit of mobility problems but you still want to enjoy the grounds, you have little shuttles that run all over the place, and you even have something set up for kids now where you know they can go out and have a lot of fun there. So a lot of stuff that goes on at the it's kind of the jewel of Sandwich, I think.
Yes, personally I call it a well-hidden secret, but, attendance has increased dramatically over the last 5 to 6 years. There are the carts that can transport folks around from one area to the other. Up in the, just above the adventure field, there is the second oldest merry-go-round in the country. It opened. Kids, adults can get up there, take a ride around on that. And then there is another area right adjacent to that called Hidden Hollow, where there's activities for youngsters there. They can build things. There's a treehouse there, just all kinds of stuff for the younger generation.
Yeah, and like you pointed out, kids of all ages. A bunch of years ago, my wife was on that merry-go-round and grabbed the ring on the way by. So it's one of those things that it can bring you back and make you a little bit younger going there too. Elliot, I want to thank you for taking a little time out of your Saturday morning and joining us on the Car Doctor program.
Okay, good. Thank you, John. It's been
all right.
A pleasure.
All right, take care, Elliot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
That was Elliot Friend from the Automotive Committee of the Heritage Museum and Gardens. It's a fantastic little place there, and I went over there to check out the IndyCar exhibit, and I happened to go there on I think it was Hydrangea Day. And I was wondering, wow, the parking lot's awful crowded fairly early in the morning, but it was awfully crowded because people are there for Hydrangea Day. So there is always a lot that goes on at the Heritage Museum. And again, there's a little bit of something for everybody, and you can check out their website to see what it's all about. And also, you can check out the website about this whole caravan that's going on, and their website address is cccaner.com. So you can find out more information about what is going on with them and the classic car caravan. And again, they're going to be kind of all over Cape Cod, it looks like, heading down to the Whittam Museum in Yarmouth and the Marconi campus and up at the Sandwich Glass Museum. So I guess people are going to learn how to, maybe they'll make new glass headlights for their car at the museum. Probably not, but there is a lot of things going on. So I was looking at the Classic Car Club of America write-up, and it says they're talking about come to Old Cape Cod when the Kids are back in school. The crowds are smaller. The weather is still great. We're pleased to announce the Grand Classic will be held on the outstanding manicure grounds of the Heritage Museum and Gardens in Sandwich, Massachusetts. If you've never been there, you're in for a treat. The gardens are superb with hydrangeas, rhododendrons, and more. There are three museum buildings, one which is a recreation of the Shaker Barn, which we were talking about. And they also have, for the members of the car club here, they've also have special access to view part of Mr. Lilly's collection of running antiques and full classics that aren't on exhibit this year. So there's a lot of great stuff there. And also, they're also going to a private collector's home, I guess, where they're going to be able to see some stuff. And I don't know this person. I'm going to have to figure out that one too. So, but a lot of interesting things going on. A lot of interesting things to look at. Hey, our buddy Rick from Boston, who is a regular listener of the program, said to me, "Hey, I've been trying to give you some advice on advice you can share." And he wrote me a letter, and somehow I never got it. It got lost at the radio station. So he wrote a second letter, which I finally got to. And he said, let's go over his, and it's driving advice. And it says, an old guy's advice to young drivers, a dozen plus one. And this is kind of what he was talking about a week or two back. And it says, it's always safer to back in and drive out of driveways and mall parking spots. That is true. We have... At AAA, when we do our driver improvement classes, we always recommend to people whenever possible, if they're not comfortable with this, especially as people get a little bit older, if they're not comfortable backing up, well, maybe find a parking space where you can drive in one side and out the other, so when it's time to leave, you're driving out rather than try to back out. Especially hard to back out of a parking space when you're in a smaller car and maybe you're stuck between two big SUVs. Ignore the driver behind you with a horn while trying to turn left onto oncoming traffic. Yes, if somebody could be beeping their horn, but don't rush because someone says it's time to go. You want to go when you think it's safe. The number one crash area for drivers over the age of 65 is turning left at a light. So be careful about that. A car approaching the intersection will probably run his just-turned red light. This week, I was just crossing over the Massachusetts-Rhode Island line, and I got off and was on a side street, and I counted three people that went through the red light, and all of them, and I don't know if it was really one following the other bad driving practices. There was no one. I was approaching the light as it turned green, so the first person going through the red light probably just looked over and went, "Oh, there's no one at that light. I'll just blow right through it." The next two people went through it as well. I don't know if they were just following the leader sort of thing and not paying attention, just assuming the light was green, or they were all trying to run the red light. Maybe they were all late for work. So be careful of those. Just because the car is not showing a turn signal doesn't mean it won't turn left in front of you. Just the opposite, I guess, too. Just because it has a turn signal on doesn't mean anything other than the bulb works. When stopped in a line of cars, leave room in front of you to get around the car you're behind if it's stalled. Always leave kind of a, and we joke about it, a rule of thumb is a rule of thumb, is your thumb, actually. So if you pull up behind a car and you can take your thumb and there's a space, if you hold your hand out and to the front of your hood and the back of the car, if you turn your thumb sideways, that much space is what you want to leave between you and the car in front of you. That will give you enough room to get around. Or I used to like to say, if you can see the tires of the car in front of you, there's probably enough room to go around that car if it's stalled or if it, at the last minute, just turns its turn signals on. So, expect the car waiting to get on the road. Let's see. Expect the car waiting to get on the road you're on to jump out and be ready for it to slow down or stop. Sometimes. I saw that the other day getting on the highway. Someone was sort of coming down to the bottom of the highway ramp, slowing down, then sped up, then slowed back down as soon as they got on the road. I don't know what that was all about. People on bikes walking like to play chicken with cars. They don't know what crosswalks are or what to do when there's no cross lights, or what the cross lights actually mean. We all need to share the road together is the bottom line on that. Bicycles, pedestrians, motorcyclists, we all need to share the road together. Remember, the other vehicle knows that he owns the road. Yeah, they think so, don't they? Tailgating, speeding, reckless driving leads to, he says, accidents. We say crashes. Fines and higher insurance costs that mean less money for your toys. That's true. If you're gonna, if you have to pay for insurance, or worse yet, a lawyer. And someday I'll talk about that story. When stopped on hills in front of you, the car in front of you may roll backwards when it starts to move forward. That's entirely possible. Although today's standard shift cars, even standard shift cars, have a kind of a clutch brake control now where they don't really roll like they used to. Even my wife's Volkswagen, which is an automatic, when you're stopped, doesn't roll backwards. Because it actually applies a brake for a second. On long trips, take frequent breaks. Plan them into your timing. You'll arrive fresher. Every couple hours is a good time to take a break. Get out, stretch a little bit, get a little bit of exercise, a little bit of air. Stay hydrated. It's important. Don't overeat when you're on the road for all kinds of reasons. John White, the first auto writer I ever met at the Boston Globe, he always used to say that the best food to take on a trip was grapes because they keep you hydrated and they quench any appetite issues. So I always thought that was good advice, and I like grapes, so why not? It's better to get there late than not at all. In other words, don't speed. And his plus one, while you're driving, While you're watching out for the other person, they'll be watching for you. You're not as good a driver as you think you are. Well, I'm not as good a driver. I never thought I was a good driver, actually. But I have made some adjustments in my driving where I know my reaction times aren't as good as they used to be. So I leave a lot more room between me and the cars in front of me, because if something happens, I have more time to slow down and react to it. When I take my eyes off the road in front of me, I kind of have my foot hovering over the brake pedal. So it takes about a half a second to a second to realize something happened in front of you. It takes about a half a second to a second to get your foot off the gas and on the brake. So if I don't have my eyes on the road, my foot's sort of hovering over the brake pedal. So if I look back and someone stopped because, I don't know, a dog ran out in the road, they saw Elvis, they saw an alien, I don't know what the case is, and you have time to be able to say, my foot's already there, I'll hit the brake, I'll slow down, I'll stop, I'll do whatever it takes to bring the car to a safe position, and that helps a lot. I got a note from the people at Harbor Freight, and it says 52 high school trade teachers up for $1 million in prizes as semifinalists in the Harbor Freight Tools for Schools 2018 Prize for Teaching Excellence. 52 skilled trade teachers and teaching teams from across the country in their high schools were named today as semifinalists in the Harbor Freight Tools for Schools Prize for Teaching Excellence and are in the running for a share of $1 million in total cash awards. The semifinalists hail from 27 states and specialize in trades ranging from construction, carpentry, to automotive repair, welding, advanced manufacturing, and agricultural mechanics. Their collective experience, including teaching students to work with solar power system, hydraulics, build tiny houses, and rebuild diesel engines, and more. The semifinalists, some competing as individuals and some as teacher teams, were selected by an independent panel of judges from among a field of more than 500 skilled trade teachers who applied for the prize. Though two more rounds of judging, the field of 52 semifinalists will be narrowed to 18 first and second place winners who will split the $1 million in cash awards. The first three place winners will receive $100,000, with $70,000 going to their public high school skilled trades program and $30,000 to the individual skilled trades teacher or teacher team behind the winning program. The 15 second place winners will be awarded $50,000, with $30,000 going to the school and $15,000 to the teacher team. Semifinalists were eligible to apply on behalf of their school's skilled trade. The first and second place winners are expected to be announced on November 15th. These semifinalists represent amazing depth and breadth in high school trades, education, and exhibit incredible enthusiasm for teaching students to work with their hands, to love learning, and be prepared for the future, says Danny Corwin. He's executive director of Harbor Freight Schools for Tools. We're thrilled to recognize the exceptional teaching to raise the profile of their excellent work through these awards. Pretty neat thing. And, you know, a lot of people have an opinion about Harbor Freight, good or bad. But when you see something like this, it's a pretty good thing. In fact, I was watching the news last night, speaking of people that have an opinion. Ernie Bach Jr. was on, and Ernie Bach has a program called called Music Drives Us, and it's a program where he donates money through his Music Drives Us charity to keep music in school. And he had an exhibit of a bunch of guitars. They're all painted with different things that meant things to each one of the individual artists. And those guitars are going to be auctioned off sometime in November with the money going to the Music Drives Us charity. And, you know, when you hear things like that and you say, you know, maybe you don't like Harbor Freight because they're you know, your opinion is they're cheap tools, or maybe you don't like Ernie Bach because of, I don't know, you don't like the way he looks, whatever the case is, and you hear things like that, that's pretty good stuff. Well, I've been talking for about 30 minutes. Why don't we take a break and pay some bills? I'm sorry, Keith, you said something there, and I didn't quite hear you. Oh, okay. Let's talk to Ben from Lawrence first before we take that break, and then when we finish talking to Ben, our phone number is 617-770-3030 if you want to get through. You're listening to the Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. How are you, Ben?
John, when are you going to start writing your auto repair book?
I don't know, maybe when I retire. How's that? I think better than an auto repair book sometimes. Yeah. I always thought that maybe I should just write a book about interesting stories that people have told me about getting their car repaired and, you know, what it took to get it repaired, and I don't know, maybe someday. Maybe someday.
I think that'll be fine because I was born in 1932. I don't have much time left. Okay.
Well, it's funny you say that because you could have a ton of time left. You never really know. But a friend of mine once said to me, we were talking about the future, and he says, here's what you want to do. He says, you know, if you're waiting to do things, he said, how long do you think you're going to live? And, you know, I said, I don't know. Maybe I'm going to live to be 80. And he said, take a tape measure out, roll it out 80 inches. And then he said, however old you are now, stand on that number on the tape measure. So if you're, you know, 60, stand on 60 inches. Look back at the 60 inches that went by and look at the 20 inches you have left. And then it kind of puts it into perspective how much time you have left. So you could have a bunch of time left, but still, whatever that time is precious. So you're right. You should do what you want to do and have some fun with it.
Good advice, John. You know, the genetics work pretty well in my family. Everybody lived close to 100, so...
There you go.
I have that hope. Okay, I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, my Impala, the airbag light came on 2 weeks ago and it stays on.
Uh-oh.
I tried checking the fuses, diagnostic. Is there a reset button on that or what?
No. You're going to have to bring it into a shop. They're going to have to scan it. One question, though. And I don't know if you've noticed, does the horn work?
Yes.
It does, okay.
Everything works, right?
Everything works, okay. Because,
but there's no reset button on that, though, right?
No, there's no.
Okay.
No, you can go out and disconnect the battery and then wait 30 seconds and hook the battery back up, and the light might go out, but it's going to come back on when it figures out there's something wrong. The airbag light is on because it's telling you there's some sort of fault, and it could be one of the, there's a series of three or two crash sensors, could be one of those. And why I asked about the horn, there's something called a clock spring. And if you think of a spring inside a clock, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And what happens is that's the thing that brings the ground up to the airbag, and it also brings the ground up for the horn. So if the clock spring's broken, usually the horn won't work, and that's what turns the light on. So it could be a sensor, it could be a wire, it could be a little bit of anything. Right now, with the airbag light on, it's telling you that the
airbag isn't working.
It's not going to work.
Okay.
The good thing is it's not going to go off either. So you don't have to worry about it. You know, having a false deployment.
Right. Well, one more question, John. I'm sure a lot of other drivers are curious about it. When new model cars come out, why do they all resemble each other? Can you explain that?
They're all designed in wind tunnels.
Okay.
And what happens, everybody's trying to go with the most aerodynamic shape possible to try to get the most fuel economy.
Right.
And they're all jelly beans. You know, they're all low in the front, curvy on the top and sometimes higher in the back, sometimes not.
Right.
But that's why they all sort of designed that way, and
have you noticed that, John?
The idea of a 58 Cadillac with you know high tail fins, you know those cars don't exist anymore, and now it's pretty hard to tell a Honda minivan from a Kia minivan. It's pretty hard to tell a Hyundai Sonata from a Ford Taurus. They all sort of have the same general shape, and everybody goes to the shape that gets the most wind over them with the least amount of resistance.
No, I thought they were merging their own thoughts. They don't work that way.
Well, you say that, though, but sometimes what happens is, if you look back at the Ford Fusion from a few years ago, that was a really good-looking car. Well, it was a really good-looking car because the designer came from Aston Martin, and that's why it looks like a little, you can see some Aston Martin in it, because he took his design from Aston Martin and brought it to Ford. So sometimes they will steal a little bit. The Koreans are pretty good at that. Hyundai and Kia are pretty good at stealing some design here and there, but that's not always the case. But it really is. They design the cars to be as efficient as they can, and that's part of the reason.
Okay, that explains it, John. I thank you very much.
All right. Okay, take care, Ben. Bye bye. 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Why don't we take a break? Pay some bills. My name is John Paul. This is the Car Doctor program on Labor Day weekend. Hopefully you're not doing too much work. We'll be right back.
Used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But
Message and data rates may apply. Please don't text while driving.
If you've been in business more than 20 minutes, you've probably printed your logo on all kinds of promotional products. We all know logos work because they're on everything from the top of skyscrapers to the bottom of shoes. Ever wondered why or how to best use your logo to grow your business? Let us show you today for free. We're 4imprint, promotional product experts at your service. We're giving away the latest issue of Amplify, the digital magazine that reveals promotional product success stories absolutely free to everyone who texts WOW22 to 88988. At 4imprint, we make your logo look perfect on thousands of promotional items. With our 100% guarantee, it'll be right the first time, on time, every time. Your free e-magazine will reveal invaluable insights that can attract new customers, build your brand, and grow your business. Get the latest issue of Amplify absolutely free by texting WOW22 to 88988. That's WOW22 to 88988.
AM 950 WROL Boston, the spirit of Boston.
A service of Salem Media Group.
I was taking a trip out to L.A., tooling along in my Chevrolet, toking on the number and digging on the radio. Just as I crossed the Mississippi line, I heard that highway start to whine, and I knew that left rear tire was about to go. Well, the spare was flat, and I got up tight, cause there wasn't a filling station in sight, so I just limped on down the shoulder on the rim. as far as I could. Want to stop.
And welcome back to the Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston, or 100.3 FM, or the app, WROLradio.com. Nissan this past Thursday said it's going to recall 166,000 vehicles to replace the ignition switch because the switches may cause the engine to shut off while the vehicles are being driven. And it's that's not the concern, which is the interesting part. The recall affects vehicles sold in Canada and the U.S., but mostly in Canada more than the U.S. But the cars are the Frontier pickup, the Sentra and Versa small cars, and the NV and NV 200 commercial vans, and in Canada also the Nissan Micra car, which is a little city car, which I have seen one of here in the United States. It had, and I'm sure there's a lot more, but I happen to see it. It was parked in a driveway, and I noticed it was parked in a driveway because it was a tow vehicle. It was, I guess they towed it behind a motorhome. Nissan said the owners of affected vehicles would begin receiving notices in the mail in September. The problem with the ignition switch is it can turn, and it can turn and shut the car off. And the concern is, I guess, if the car shuts off, and it can go from on to the accessory position. And when that happens, besides the car shutting off, it shuts the airbag system off. So besides the car acting like it just stalled, and the concern seems to be more that the airbag won't work because the key's in the off position. So the automaker says if you own one of these vehicles, take all your keys off your key ring and just have a key and a, I don't know, keychain and not a bunch of stuff. You sometimes see that people have all kinds of things hanging off their key ring, everything from a ton of keys to a flashlight to a pocket knife to a, I don't know, self-defense weapon to, you know, every discount card from or an affinity card, everything from their gym to the drugstore to whatever the case is. So there's a lot, you know, people kind of overburden their ignition switch by having way too many things on it. Some of these big push-button remotes, you know, if you have a car with a big remote, and then you have another car with a big remote, now all of a sudden you have a couple bulky things on your key ring. And those aren't really a good idea to carry all that stuff around. It just puts too much wear and tear on the ignition switch itself. So, and as you recall, back in 2014, General Motors started recalling cars over defective ignition switches, which had similar issues. So you want to watch out for that. Our phone number, 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030 is how you get through. We have a caller on the line, plus we also have a couple lines open. So if you want to join us, 617-770-3030. Good morning. Good morning, John. You're on the Car Doctor program. Hello.
Hello, John.
Hi there. Yes, sir.
Hey, John, I got a question there. I got a 2019 Subaru Ascent, and on the thing there, it claims 22 average miles per gallon between city and highway.
Yep.
Now, I called them up, excuse me, and I told them, I said, I'm not even getting that. In fact,
Yeah, well, first off, how many miles do you have on the car?
It's turned over 1,000.
Yeah, see, you know, part of the problem is it's gonna take, and we're kind of losing you. It seems like we're losing your cell phone here a little bit. But the I think it's going to take 5,000 miles or so before the engine breaks in and loosens up. So I wouldn't worry about mileage for quite a, you know, until you get, you know, 5 or 6,000 miles on it. By then the engine's going to be broken in, and you'll get a better idea of what you're going to get for fuel economy. You know, those are averages. Those are averages based on some EPA test cycles. They're also averages that the vehicle manufacturers look at. You know, right now, you know, if it says you're supposed to get 22 on average and you're getting in the 15 somewhere, I wouldn't be too concerned about it. But I would just note it and wait and see what happens. And then kind of go from there. But I wouldn't expect to see the mileage really start to get normal until the engine's really broken in. And hopefully by then you'll see something pretty close to what it says. On the cars that I road test, and I road test a lot of cars over the course of a year, I'm usually within 10% of whatever the number is. So, and I'm going by the digital display, which I will admit is sometimes a little over-optimistic. But, and then sometimes I exceed it, but sometimes I don't come close. The last car that I drove was a little less than the average. Could have had to do with the way I was driving it. City driving, that really chews up the fuel. So it's really gonna depend, and we'll have to wait and see. So, John, I hope that helps you out. Yeah, John, we're going to have to let you go. Your cell phone sounds like you just drove through the tunnel with it. So, John, thanks for calling, and give it some time is the best thing to do. All right, well, let's try the second John of the morning here, Norwood. John, good morning. Good morning.
Morning, John.
How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good.
I got a question. A couple of times, I'd say like twice within a month, I've found like globs of grease on the mud flap behind the passenger front tire, maybe half the size of a golf ball. So I thought, well, maybe the CV joint boot was ripped, but I looked at it, and it doesn't appear. Can you think of anything that would leave that in the same spot within a month, other than the CV?
No, that's really about the only thing that's there. I mean, if it's not ripped, it could be the clamp is loosened up enough that it's squirted some grease. Now you have to remember when the car goes up and down or turns left and right, that boot is compressing and expanding. And if that clamp on the boot is a little bit loose, you're going to literally squirt grease out of there like toothpaste out of a toothpaste tube. So you could get under there if you felt ambitious enough to crawl on the ground and squeeze the boot and see if anything comes out of it. And if it does, you know the answer. The other possibility could be just as goofy as you hit a big glob of grease in the road a couple of times and it just spun up and hit the same spot and that was kind of it. That's possible, I guess. But I'm kind of thinking it still might be an issue with the boot. How old a car is it?
It's almost 20 years old now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so it's entirely possible. And what happens these days, too, nobody replaces a boot anymore. They end up replacing the entire axle because a rebuilt axle is about the same price a boot used to be 15 years ago.
And if you do that, you should do them in pairs, right?
No, when it comes to things like that, I believe in fix what's broken. Especially you have to think about, what happens when you turn the steering wheel. There's always one wheel that turns more than the other, and that's what puts the additional stress on the boot. In alignment talk, it's called toe outer and turns, and it stresses the boot a little bit more. And again, age, if you had the one axle you replaced, would I replace the left front axle just because? Nah, not until I saw a problem with it.
So there's a clamp on both ends of the...
On both ends. There's the inner and outer CV joint. The inner one just sort of moves in and out. The outer one is the one that obviously bends as the wheels turn left and right. And both of those can squirt grease out of them. But there's a little clamp, just the size of the axle, which is maybe an inch and a half across. And then there's the big clamp, which is 3.5 or 4 inches. And either one of those clamps could start to leak a little bit. Not unusual in a car as it gets a little bit older. And like I said, it from all the movement, if the clamp isn't doing its job, well, that can be squirting out some grease. So, you know, that's what I would look at. If I got under there with a flashlight and everything looked okay and I didn't see any grease squirted all over or anything, I think I'd just wash off the mud flap and not worry about it.
That may be my course of action. Just to, if it happens a third time, I'll get under there again. But
There you go. So start with some car wash soap and if you don't see anything, a third time, you ran over a big gob of grease in the road. There was a you were driving on the same road where somebody just did a grease job on a dump truck and over greased everything and left a bunch of grease in the road.
I got one other question for you.
Sure.
If I can.
Sure, absolutely.
My girlfriend's Honda, it's a 2013 Civic.
Yep.
Had a recall because the paint is clouding and cracking.
Okay.
She took it into the Honda dealership in West Roxbury, I think. They're
yep.
the ones that are going to do the recall.
Yep.
And they're saying just paint the top of the car, the hood, and the top of the trunk. That car's got pretty, you know, wide front fenders that abut it. I mean, are they going to be able to make that paint match the paint that's going to be left on the areas that they're not repainting or saying so far that they don't want to repaint?
Depends on the painter. They're going to, there's, I have seen people blend paint from panel to panel, and that's what they do. They don't paint the panel specifically, especially if there's a little bit of fade that's happened over the past, you know, 5 years or so. But they do blend the finish off to the adjoining fenders a little bit. And yeah, if you're out in a parking garage with a bunch of fluorescent lights, you may see the deviation in the paint color. But if you're out in bright sunlight, most of the time, you know, that's kind of the key to how well they did getting the paint to match, is how well did they blend it, is, you know, how's it look in bright sun. I was talking to somebody not that long ago that had some trim painted on their car, and all they did was picked the factory color, painted it, and put the wheel well arches on it, and it wasn't even close. You know, I don't know how the service department could have given the car back in looking at it and saying, oh yeah, it looks fine. It didn't even come close to looking fine. So it really depends on the service department and the painter who does the work. I mean, after all, you know, fenders get dinged and dented all the time, and you know, they straighten the dents out and they paint them and they blend them in and they can get them to match pretty well. Why they're doing all the flat surfaces is it's kind of a problem that almost every vehicle manufacturer has had, is the water-based paints that we use now are nowhere near as robust as the old paints used to be. On top of that, the primers that they use today are really good about keeping corrosion to a minimum. The bad thing is they're very sensitive to ultraviolet light. So, and the only thing that keeps the primer from starting to have problems is the paint on top of the primer. Well, what happens is this ultraviolet light makes its way through the flat surfaces, the hood, the roof, and the trunk, and then because of that, the primer starts to move a little bit, and that's what causes the fading and the checking in the paint. So they have to go down, they have to sand the paint, scuff up the primer, sometimes put a new coat of primer on it, new base coat, new clear coat, and it's good to go. And again, it's really up to the painter. If you get the car back and you go, wow, you know, the car's red, but the new paint looks orange, then you gotta say to them, hey, look, that's terrible. And again, the key is, how does it look out in sunlight? And that's kind of the body shop rule that I was taught and I always go by, what's it look like in natural sunlight? If it looks good in natural sunlight, it's as good as it's going to be. You know, you might look at it under halogen or fluorescent lights and go, I can see where they touched, where they blended it in. Well, that isn't where the car gets driven. The car gets driven in sunlight. So, you know, if it matches in sunlight, it's good.
And is black any more difficult than any other color?
Blacks, any dark color is difficult because what happens is, generally speaking, black is black and it's an easy color to match. The problem with black is, and any dark color is, it shows any imperfections. So it really depends on how they prep the car to start off with. So this car could very well have, you know, a little bit of dings and dents in the paint. Anything that wasn't sanded properly is going to show up more with the dark color than it will with the light color. So matching wise, it's probably a lot easier, unless this car is, you know, sat in Arizona sunlight for 5 years. But chances are black's going to match pretty well, I would think.
Okay. Thanks for
the
help, John.
All right, take care. Bye-bye now. 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. I mentioned once a while back that it was time for me to buy a new car. My 11-year-old car was just starting to be an 11-year-old car. So I went out and kind of looked at a variety of different cars, and I had a very limited budget because, well, I work for a living, and unlike some other folks, I don't. In fact, I got an email from somebody that wants me to meet them, and they said, my only decision is, do I take the Shelby GT350 or do I take the 428 Mustang? Well, I don't have those kind of problems. So, but I went out and bought a Hyundai Santa Fe Sport because it was a good value. I got a good price on it. I bought it over at Prime Hyundai on the South Shore. And one of the reasons they were discounting the car so much is because Hyundai has come up with a new Santa Fe, and there's an article, and it was introduced recently in Park City, Utah, a place where I've been. In an interesting place it is. But the redesigned 2019 Hyundai Santa Fe gets several changes, starting with its name. Hyundai is dropping the Sport from its name of the smaller five-passenger version. The brand will have one more year of selling down the three-row Santa Fe under the name of Santa Fe XL. So the bigger Santa Fe, they're going to call Santa Fe XL. And then they'll replace it with a new nameplate. The nameplate is expected to be called Palisade. Not a great name. When we launched the previous generation, the idea was to maximize the efficiency of our marketing, said Mike O'Brien, Hyundai Motor Vice President of Product, Corporate, and Digital Planning. During the media introduction, we had the Veracruz, which we had the Santa Fe, and we never spent enough money on all of our kids, it says here. One kid got a college education, and the other kid only went to high school. We thought by having a common name, Santa Fe, we would be more efficient by marketing Sport. But what we learned, probably more, it was more confusing than efficient. Hyundai saw the confusion as shoppers configured the vehicle online. Entering Santa Fe took them to the 8-passenger, 3-row version, rather than the smaller Santa Fe Sport, so there it goes. Hyundai expects the addition of the redesigned Santa Fe, which is going on sale now alongside the Kona Subcompact and the freshened Tucson, to boost the crossover share of sales. We're going to bring more production capacity. We're going to bring more of our products. Hyundai believes some Santa Fe conquest opportunity will come from owners of more expensive vehicles thanks to the more premium look of the redesign. Yeah, it has LED style lights, it looks like, at least in the picture that I'm seeing. It has a more prominent grill. It looks more Lexus or Acura looking than Hyundai looking. It looks like at least the standard model is going to come complete with roof rails, not a roof rack, but at least roof rails. It says here the cabin uses multiple textures, more supportive seats, a headliner fabric that looks more like the material on a high-end sofa, door panels with embossed geometric pattern. We really spent a lot on the effort on the design side. We also, on refinement of noise, vibration, and harshness, which people associated with a premium vehicle. I actually think my Hyundai Santa Fe Sport actually rides pretty well. It's a good direction for a brand. It's a better, more profitable place to be in the marketplace. So it also It has a pretty decent starting price. It says here it's going to start at $26,480, which I think is only about $1,000 more than the previous version. Safety is also, there's going to be a full suite of safety features, all standard, so they'll all now have forward collision avoidance assist, driver attention warning, blind spot collision warning, and lane keeping assistant, among other features. The standard safety features are resonating with Hyundai customers. Initially, our dealers questioned our safety strategy, but it's true, it was easier to buy the mid-level model when I was looking at vehicles than the base model, because I was more concerned about price and features, so I was looking for a car that was a little bit cheaper. We asked our dealer council at a meeting if they thought they made the right decision. They unanimously said yes, and we'll have to wait and see. So what's the difference between this one and the old one? Well, the powertrain is a 2.4-liter four-cylinder engine rated at 185 horsepower, or a 2-liter four-cylinder engine rated at 235 horsepower. Both come with an 8-speed transmission. A diesel engine is planned for the future. The base engine is the same base engine they're using now. It uses a 7-inch multimedia touchscreen, 8-inch on the ultimate trim level, and Android Auto and Apple CarPlay capability. 4 USB ports are among the standard tech features. My car, because it's a base model, only has like a 5-inch display screen for the radio and other features. I don't have Android Auto or Apple CarPlay. Again, that was the next model up. I didn't really care about those. Safety, standard forward collision avoidance, and all the other safety features I just mentioned. Also, parking distant warning, rear occupant alert are standard on the higher end models and higher trims. They want to their competitors, they think, with this are Ford Edge, Nissan Murano, Jeep Cherokee, Subaru Outback. I wonder why they didn't say things like Toyota Highlander. Maybe they're going to compete. They're thinking that's competitive with the next model up. And it is a little bit of a tweener, I guess. It's sort of in between the compact and the midsize. What they think the sharp strength, according to whoever wrote this article, it says good looks inside and out in a segment with either too much going on or not enough. A day spent driving the high altitudes of Utah showed off the Santa Fe's handling, whether around town or off the beaten path. It was up to the challenge. They're saying they should have a diesel variant available when they introduced it, and they think that's a weakness. I'm not so sure, actually. In some markets, definitely in the U.S., diesel is still about 50 cents per gallon higher. Diesel engines are for everyone. I don't know that it really hurts them that much not having a diesel ready right now. The bottom line is, says the optional turbo engine along with the all-wheel drive combined with the look similar to the already popular Kona subcompact could make the redesigned Santa Fe an enticing option for crossover customers. You know, well, one of these days when I have a little bit of time, I'll have to really sit down and price my car out kind of as standard model with this and see, you know, should I have waited, I guess is the question. I don't know. I decided I needed a car, so I didn't wait, and that's how it works sometimes. So that's the way it goes. Our phone number is 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Why don't we talk to Frank from Medford? Frank, is that you? Frank? Where are you, Frank?
Good morning, John Paul.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Pretty well. I called up the dealer to bring back that 2009 Chevy Traverse there that got the misfire after the timing chain was
gone. Yep.
And they said that, he kind of confused me about codes and stuff as far as saying that it's, there's historical codes and there's other codes, and he didn't find it, I think, on the historical or something like this here or whatever there that he's gonna take a look at it. But what I was wondering is if, they did the timing chain, right, and it was the 1 and 5 cylinder were misfiring. So
right.
We get the car back, then only the 1 cylinder is showing misfiring, and it only shows up like when you try to go on the highway and give it gas, it kind of hesitates like.
Uh-huh.
So would that be the problem originally started with the converter there crumbling or whatever there, and I'm wondering if the, like on the older cars, they had a dog leg And that used to reintroduce the exhaust into the cylinder there, and I'm wondering, yep. could that have damaged the one cylinder or something? Is that possible? On that gear, they're only like a couple of months old on the on that back side of the engine.
It's also possible it's got an, you know, the way you describe it where you get the misfire code when it comes up as you're getting onto the highway, it does sound like an electrical, like a bad coil, could be a bad coil pack, could be a bad plug still, even though it's 3 months old, it could be a bad plug. So I think at this point, you know, the idea that you have in kind of a misfire on a couple of cylinders, they determined it was because of a worn chain, and now you're getting a misfire on one cylinder. I guess you really need to find out what it is, and if it's a result of the if it's a result of something they did, or is a result of something they haven't done yet. And the thing about saying, well, there's historic codes, if they're trying to say, hey, you know, we took care of the problem. Those were codes that were already in there. We cleared the codes when we gave it back to you, and now there's a new code coming up, and the new code means a new problem, not an old problem. Well, that's nonsense. You know, they cleared the codes, and you know, the codes that were there, and you know, if they're completely different than they were previous. So, in other words, if one of the codes came up, now the EGR valve's not working properly, or there's an oxygen sensor that's not working properly. Well, those are different, but these are misfire codes. So if it was a misfire and the misfire was tied down to a sloppy chain, well, that's one thing. Now we need to find out what's causing whatever it is, you know, misfire cylinder one or whatever it is, and find out the root cause of what that is. And it's possible, of course, that, you know, even though those spark plugs are 3 or 4 months old, you know, could one of them have, you know, from the misfire caused by this faulty chain, could one of them have gotten enough contamination where under load it misfires? Maybe. I think under load, if it's misfired, it might have a bad coil pack.
Well, he's saying that he thinks that it could also be carbon. He said that those engines are noted for carbon problems with the, and I, you know, that's new to me. I mean, I don't know anything about that, whether, you know. And I'm saying, like, in the old days, you used to take the car, if you had carbon buildup or something, you'd go on 93 or something there and boot it, you know, clean it out or something like that.
No, I mean, they might actually recommend, possibly, I guess, is adding some, you know, running a carbon cleaner through it where they disconnect the fuel system and run a carbon flush. And there's GM has their own one, BG Products has their own. There's a bunch of them that Snap-on has theirs. They all have a carbon cleaner. You could go out and buy a can of Tecron at an auto parts store, run it through a tank of gas, run a second can through another tank of gas, see if it's changed, and that will clean up the carbon inside the engine to some extent. Use a brand name gasoline like Shell or Mobil. That will help keep some of the carbon. That'll cut down on some of the carbon because of the additives that's in that. Shell, Mobil, Citgo, they all have a little bit more additive in it than some of the no name gas. Try that. And if all of that doesn't make any difference, I would still want to spend some time, you know, look at the code, look at what cylinder it's indicating it's misfiring, and then try to find what the cause is of that, even to the point where, you know, switch a coil from one side of the engine to the other, and see if the misfire travels, and then you know, well, you got a bad coil pack, and you can buy some of these coils online, pretty inexpensively too. But I would go back to them, and I think they at least owe it to you to tell you what's wrong with it at this point. You spent a bunch of money having a timing chain put on, or at least a bunch of time, and I think that at this point they owe you at least an answer about why the light's coming back on. You brought it in with a light on. And you said, tell me what's wrong with it and fix it and make the light go out. And they said, okay, and now the light's back on. So I think they at least owe you that to say let's take a look at it and see what it is. And you know, that's got six individual coils, so an easy check, if you can get to the, if it's one of the coils you can get to, is you pop the coil out, you put it in, you know, instead of in cylinder one, you put it in cylinder three or five or whatever's closest, and you put the coil back in and you clear the codes and you drive down the road, and next time the light comes on, if all of a sudden it says cylinder five misfiring, well, you know it's a bad coil because the misfire moved from one cylinder to another.
Right. Yeah. I think that the problem is with on the cylinder one, I think that's the one that begins the firewall, and I think that you know, that's why they don't pull the plug or clean the plug or check the plug, because you're going to pull the intake manifold and everything.
Yeah. They didn't make it easy for you. I'll say that, but still, you know, that's, you know, you went in with the problem, and you know,
right.
it's just
that was on the, because you told me about the recall notice for that, for the timing change on those in, and that's, you know, the dealer and GM ate the timing change,
right,
you know
what right,
I mean?
But, right, and you're right, that is, you know, cylinder one is the kind of the passenger side rear.
Right.
Yeah, and yeah, it's no fun to get to, you know, I'll say that, but I guess where they looked at it and took care of it, still I would still say to them, hey, look, you know, is there something else? And let's face it, if it needs a coil, it needs a coil. You got to bite the bullet and put it in.
Sure.
You know, if it is one of the rear coils, you know, it's unfortunately the difference is, you know, in the to do one coil in the ones you can get at takes about 10 minutes. To do one coil in the ones you can't get at, you know, it takes an hour and a half. So
right,
you know, so it's going to cost you a couple $100 in labor to replace the coil and check the plug, but you can't drive around with the engine misfiring, because you're going to dilute the oil, you're going to cause all kind of problems. So you might have to spend some of your own money to take care of it.
Sure. Now, what I was wondering was, when they do the timing chain, do they have to take off the intake manifold or anything, or can they access that without doing the intake?
No, they can just pull. There's a bunch of covers, but other than that, they don't have to take the intake off.
No, that's what I thought they might not have to.
Yeah.
I know on the old ones you wouldn't have to, but
again, it's one of those things that it's kind of funny. You're the third person I've talked to that's had a time and chain problem of one kind or another, you know, over the past week or two. And time and chains are usually designed to last for the life of the car, and they usually do, unless they don't. And when they don't, you know, it's usually a reason because of a defect of some kind. And you know, it's either a tensioner that's gone bad or something else has gone bad with it, and that's you know, where the problem is. But
the third timing chain in the vehicle, the first one went at 24,000 under the regular warranty, and then they covered it this time because it was under the 100,000 miles with the 10 year or whatever, you know. So it's a third timing chain in the vehicle. I mean, it's like I don't know what, you know.
Yeah, and that's an. That's,
like, just get rid of the car.
Yeah, and that's an interesting car, because it uses a primary chain and a secondary chain, and you know, there is, you know, and like you said, they knew that there's a problem with it, and that's why they came out with this, you know, they call it a special coverage adjustment, which means that we're extending the warranty because what we made didn't last very well. So.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, so It's they don't have to take off the intake manifold, but they did have interestingly enough have to lower part of the front suspension to get to it. So.
Right. Yeah, I know they had to take apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's, side.
But, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, but I would get a either go back to them or get a second opinion with somebody. And like I said, well, I mean, I guess two things: either you can get rid of the car, which gets rid of the problem, or you can go back to them and say, hey, look, you took care of the time and chain. Let's find out what else is a problem. And like I said, could it be an ignition coil? Ignition coils on GM cars fail pretty regularly, so it's entirely possible.
Oh, they do. Yeah, I wasn't sure of that.
Yeah, they do.
The but she now the converter has to be replaced. I know that, right?
Right. Yeah.
That rear back one, and the problem is, like you say, if I don't find out what's wrong with that cylinder, I don't want to go spending thousands on converters, and you know what I mean, and have
right.
a bad engine.
You're absolutely right, because what happens is if you spend all the money on a converter. And then that cylinder's still misfiring. You're going to melt that converter's going to turn into a, you might as well just go melt, $1,000 into a pile and throw it away.
Right. Oh, yeah, because it'll destroy the converter.
Right. Exactly. So I would go back to him and say, hey, look, the check engine light's still on. Can you tell me what you think it is? And if they come back to you and say, we're pretty confident based on what we see, it's an ignition coil or something. Could it be an intake manifold gasket that's bad? I guess it could be, but more common is usually a ignition misfire. And the way you describe it, where you're getting to go out on the highway, you give it some gas to get up to speed, and all of a sudden that's where you get the misfire. That to me is classic secondary ignition or primary ignition failure, and that's where you see it. So I think that's what it is, but time will tell. Somebody's got to look at it.
Yeah, because years ago, like when you put the engine under a load, usually it was like your fuel pump wasn't pumping.
I mean, back then you could actually run a car out of gas if the fuel pump was bad. You'd put it to the floor, and the pump couldn't pump fast enough to keep the bowl in the carburetor full. Now with
right.
today's fuel injected cars, fuel pumps either work or they don't, pretty much. And I mean, you can check for fuel volume and pressure, but I don't think it's that. I think it's an ignition misfire.
Yeah, and to get the waiver for the vehicle, I mean, just, we bought it at that dealership that did the work.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm saying, used, but I'm saying for the waiver on that, you'd have to replace the converter, right?
They won't do a waiver on a bad converter, because the idea of a waiver is whatever's wrong with the car is... although it might cause the check engine light to come on, which is going to keep you from getting a sticker, they still won't. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts says, well, you can't have a car that's polluting the air. So a bad catalytic converter is I believe generally exempt from any waivers. So that's one of those things you're going to have to think about getting fixed.
Right.
But like you said,
we'll test the dealership out by saying how much can we get for a trade-in.
there you go. The problem is they're going to say to you, well, the car's going to need a new catalytic converter, so we got to take $1,500 off the trade. It's funny. I just talked to or emailed with somebody this week that had some problems with the car, and they said. I'm trying to think how it went. They said it was they had to replace part of the engine, and they said, well, prior to the trade-in, the car was worth $16,000, and because the engine had been repaired and the work that was done to it, now the car is only worth $12,000. And I'm like, well, that's just the opposite. There's no evidence that says once a car is repaired, it's worth less than it would be if it wasn't repaired. So, but in your case, it needs work, so you might be better off trying to trade it with somebody who doesn't have as much history on it, because they're going to tell you, well, you know, here's what we know is wrong with it, so we've got to take this amount off. Even though the cost of repairing it should be what they're looking at, not the, you know, the cost of their cost of repairing it, not the cost of retail repairs, so...
Right. Yeah. Especially, you know, the funny thing is, you know, you're talking to the guy at the dealership there that does the appointments, right? And he goes, "This used to be my mother's car." He goes, "That's when the timing chain went at 24,000.
Oh, okay.
And I'm saying, like, this is really bizarre that, you know, you're talking to the guy that mother knew to get rid of it. Did he probably told her to get rid of the car?
No, I mean, you never know. It's funny. I the car I had before this one, I bought it from a car dealership down in Weymouth, S&E Auto Sales, nice little dealership. They also own a Mitsubishi franchise. And I brought it in once for their complimentary, you know, I think you got a couple years worth of oil changes, and I happen to be in the neighborhood, so I went in and got an oil change. And sure enough, there's the car I traded in sitting on the lift. And I said, "Oh, what's my old car doing here?" And they said, "Oh, that's your old car? We didn't know that." The service guys didn't know that. And I said, "I said, yeah." And he said, "It developed a rusty transmission line, so we're repairing that under our warranty." And I said, "Oh, okay." And you know, afterwards, I'm thinking one of the reasons the car looked stunning inside and out, but underneath it was getting rustier than I wanted it to be, which is one of the reasons why just 5 years old, I decided to trade it in, because I knew that if I kept it 4 or 5 more years, I was going to be faced with the same thing. I didn't know it was going to happen quite as soon as it did. So, it's amazing how that's a small world sometimes.
Yeah, it is.
All right.
Well, have a happy Labor Day, John.
You as well. Take care now. Right. Bye-bye. 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Let's talk to Mike in Bridgewater. And it's funny, I was talking about Labor Day the other day, and I said, Labor Day, what does that actually come from? And, you know, we sort of made something up until we looked it up, and it was actually the Carpenters Union. Carpenters and Joiners Union were the ones that that established the Labor Day holiday. Well, let's talk to Mike. Michael.
Morning, John.
Good morning.
John, I want to talk about generally cruise control, smart cruise control, pedestrian detection, and manufacturers might call it something like stop and go creep along in traffic, that kind of thing.
Okay.
I know typically, you know, cruise control doesn't work under certain miles per hour, and I believe I understand smart cruise control keeps you a certain distance from the vehicle in front. But my question is kind of this. If you have smart cruise control and pedestrian detection, do you also have the capability of, you know, stop and go creep along? Is it a hardware issue where manufacturer would have to put on a separate piece of hardware? Or is it just a software change or, you know, pedestrian detection, that kind of thing? I was just wondering if that's something that can be an upgrade to an existing car that has, you know, the newer version.
Yeah. I don't know if it can be an upgrade to an existing car. And here's sort of, smart cruise control uses a series of sensors and radar and laser sometimes and a variety of things. And what it does, smart cruise control keeps a electronic distance between you and the car in front of you. And if you set the cruise control for 60 miles an hour and traffic slows down to 30 or 40 miles an hour, it will slow down with it, and it'll keep that same buffer distance between you and the car in front of you. If the car in front of you comes to a complete stop, depending on the manufacturer, it can start up again depending on how long you're stopped. Some cars, if you're stopped for more than a second or two, you have to hit the cruise control button or physically step on the gas pedal yourself to get it to move again. Most of them, if you just hit the resume button, it'll start back up and follow the car at the same speed in front of you. The cars that have pedestrian detection systems, like some of the Volvos and Mercedes and Audis and some others, those cars will do the same thing. If a pedestrian runs up, if you're going 10 miles an hour or 5 miles an hour in traffic, and the cruise control is still keeping your speed at 5 miles an hour because that's as fast as a car in front of you going, and a pedestrian runs across in front of you, and the system detects the pedestrian, it just shuts it off, and in some cases will apply, fully apply, some cases partially apply the brake. The problem is why I don't think you can do a software upgrade is I used to work with a very thin guy, and I bet if he weighed 115 pounds, it was a lot. And we were at an auto show where they were demonstrating the pedestrian detection system, and he kind of turned sideways and ran in front of it, and it never saw him.
So
I think the idea of saying, well, we can put an additional system in place to make the system work like the very newest systems, I don't think they can. I think the newest systems have to rely on additional, more robust hardware to work.
Okay, because I was thinking with basically this thing called CitySense where it would stop and go traffic for you, that kind of thing. If you have those things in place, is that something that's just a switch, you know, like Tesla gives you a switch and then you get more,
well,
more files
well,
and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
You know what I mean, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think if it's got all of that stuff going for it, I think it's more than a switch. And it's sort of, and he hasn't responded back to me. I'm a little disappointed. There's a guy, and I think he's up in the Salem, Mass area, and he's got a YouTube channel called Rich Rebuilds, and he actually rebuilds Teslas. He finds junkyard Teslas. He's some sort of electrical engineer, and he rebuilds Teslas. And one of the things that he tries to get is information from Tesla about, you know, what I want to do to the car. And Tesla pretty much shuts him off. And we're in a state where there's right to repair. And he's I really want to talk to him about this and, you know, everything he does with rebuilding Teslas because he sounds like a pretty interesting guy. So I'm waiting to hear back from him. But, yeah, I think a matter of them being able to, you know, if you have a Volvo, you know, city safety system, or you have Subaru EyeSight, and you're thinking, well, my car is 2 years old, can it get better with just software? I think some things can maybe get better with software because the software is going to enhance what's there. But I think when it comes down to actually really physically being able to detect things like a pedestrian, I think that's a hardware change. I think that's better sensors. And I know that's what they did in the Subaru because the Subaru system actually will shut off in very bright sunlight, very hot temperatures, and very cold temperatures, as well as rain and snow, anything that blocks the sensor. And the newest system is much more much less reliant on temperature. So on very cold days, it's they've made it in such a way where it's less likely to shut down. And that had to do with the sensors itself and not the software. So I think that's more the case.
Okay, I just want to say thank you, John. I appreciate the information I get from your show and wanted to wish you and your wife a happy holiday.
Well, thank you very much. Same to you as well, and go out to eat someplace good. All right, take care. Oh, let's see if we can get one more call in. Jack from Watertown. Jack, go ahead.
Hi, John Paul. Hey, on a coolant fan that doesn't work on a 2003 Lincoln Town Car, did I bother replacing that, or is that an important thing to get replaced?
It's definitely an important thing to replace. I would find the coolant temp sensor first, the one that runs the fan, ground it, see if the fan comes on. That will tell you if you got a bad sensor. Run power to the fan, see if the fan comes on. That will tell you if you got a bad fan. And in between there's a lot of computer stuff in between that turns it on and off. But a bad coolant fan, if you're stuck out in the highway, I mean, if you're stuck out in traffic, in stop and go traffic, the car's going to overheat, so you want to get it fixed.
I recommend anyone to get a used 2003 Lincoln Town Car. It's like driving around in a living room.
There you go. There you go. If you want to drive around in a living room, it's a good thing. Okay, take care now. Have a great weekend. All right, bye-bye. Hey, I bet our buddy Paul Sullivan's in the studio. Let's see if he is. Sully, are you there?
Yeah.
Look at you.
You got like a 50% chance of me being here, I guess, on any given week, right?
Well, I think it's a little higher than that, but I got a 50-50 chance of who's going to be filling in for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so what's up for the Irish Hit Parade on this Labor Day weekend.
Well, yeah, it's Labor Day weekend, so, you know, it's not only that, it's September 1st, so we'll play nothing but the best music from Ireland, as we have done every Saturday since, I think it was July something, 1967.
Oh, well, it's been a long time.
October, I'm not sure.
one of those.
I think longer than that.
I wasn't here then.
Yeah, me either, but, you know, it is September, but I'm going to think that doesn't mean fall and cold weather coming and turning the heat on and all those kind of things, even though all the predictions are for a miserable winter.
I heard it's going to be 93 degrees, like, on Tuesday, so the summer's not gone away yet.
I remember
calendar summer's not, I know they talk about meteorological summer, but on the calendar, summer's got three more weeks, right?
An old-timer once said to me, don't let the calendar be your guide of life.
Well, and if you're on the Cape, which you might be in that, posh but not overly ostentatious studio that you have there, the Cape in September is wonderful.
It is. The Cape in September is a wonderful place to be, and that's all I have. So the piano man means I have to go. The very best in Irish music coming up with Paul Sullivan and the Irish Hit Parade. Until next week. Make sure you wear your seatbelt, drive safely, and be good to your car. Talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.